You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Jocunda Belli, the author of the novel The Inhabited Woman, recently published by Curbstone Press. She's the author of several books of poetry, translated into English is From Eve's Rib, also from Curbstone. Well, at one point in this novel, The Inhabited Woman, Lavinia, the heroine, is asked how she got her name, and she says that her mother liked Latin names. I'm going to ask you about your name first.
Well, it's the same origin. My mother liked strange names, and she liked, you know, since we had an Italian last name, she thought we should have appropriate first names for our last name. So we all have, you know, Italian names. But my sisters and mine, Lavinia is my sister. I have a sister named Lavinia, I mean, and Lavinia and Gioconda are the two names that are the most exotic in the family.
Now tell me, the first time I read of you, I was reading The Jaguar Smile by Salman Rushdie, and he had attended a poetry reading in Nicaragua where he first heard your work. Can you tell me what the poetry scene is like in Nicaragua? It seems very different from what it is like here.
Well, Nicaragua is a country that has an incredible love for poetry, and it's spread in the whole population. It's not something for the elite. And we had organized a collective reading of seven women poets, and we had choreographed the reading, very simple choreography. And we read, the seven of us, one, you know, in sort of a moving on the stage, mm-hmm. as we had to advance to read. And this was a reading that was organized in a center where there are ruins from the earthquake that destroyed Managua in 72. And it's a very sort of ghostly frame for this kind of thing. And it was very nice. And we had this reading. And Salman Rushdie was in Nicaragua attending the festivities for one of the anniversaries of the revolution. And so he, you know, this became a part of those festivities, and he was invited to this reading. And he was amazed at the fact that people enjoyed the reading and were sitting there for 2 hours just listening to poetry, no music, no other kind of entertainment. Just solid poetry reading for 2.5 hours. And that is, you know, people really like it in Nicaragua. They can listen to poetry for a long time.
Now, I'm curious. As Americans, we're aware of the poetry of the revolution, but is there a fascist poetry as well?
Well, not really. What there was a group called the Vanguard Movement in poetry that was very important in Nicaragua, and these people were Pablo Antonio Cuadra, José Coronel Urtecho, a number of poets that fell in love with American poets from the time of Ezra Pound, William Carlos Williams, and because they had this link with Ezra Pound and they loved his poetry, there was they had a little bit of a cult, mm-hmm. of fascism at the time, you know, and because of the especially with the Spanish fascism, the Primo de Rivera, but that passed. I mean, it was not really a political movement. Mm-hmm. It was more like a pose that they took on, and the love for the American poets was something very important because it brought that poetry to my generation. For example, we learned about all these poets, and they were very influential in the development of the subsequent generations of poets in Nicaragua.
You seem in particular very influenced by Neruda, is that correct?
Well, I don't know. You know, I have heard that before. I have been told that before.
Well, in America, we may not know. Neruda may stand here for someone else, you know, that you encountered.
Well, that's a great compliment for me, because I have a great love for Neruda and his poetry. I think he, in a way, I can understand, you know, the influence that you see, because I think my poetry has a collective breath to it.
Yes.
That is very much what Neruda's poetry had, which made it, you know, transcend in a way the Chile, the frontiers of Chile, and became this loved, that poetry that we loved in Latin America and that politically was very important. So I think that the political side of my poetry can be traced to that legacy of political poetry.
But also the incantatory quality.
Yes, yes,
I'm curious. I identify that with Neruda, but that may be part of a much longer tradition.
Well, you know what I identify more with, in my case, but in my particular case, with Whitman. Because if I can say that somebody has influenced me, I think I would really say that Walt Whitman really struck a very important chord in me when I was becoming a poet, when I was growing up. And this kind of breath that he has, this incredible poetic resonance, and it seems that he's same his poetry on the top of a mountain, calling, you know, for the people of the world to listen, and in a way, as a poet, you want to do that. I mean, you it's like a prophetic mission, and when you tie this in with a political life, you know, with having been involved in a revolution and all that, it's inevitable that you have this incantatory, you know, this epic tone. You have to take it on, because in a way it's what allows you to understand war, to find a meaning in the things that are so meaningless, you know.
I'm speaking to Jacunda Belli in particular about her novel, The Inhabited Woman, published by Curbstone Press. It seemed that in framing the narration with the voice of a spirit who has entered a tree, an orange tree, that you were searching to write a poetic novel, or a novel that would have all the resources of poetry as well as of prose. Did that begin as a poem, in fact?
No, it didn't. It didn't. It began as an exercise in description, really. I was trying to find a medium that would allow me to say what I wanted to say, to tell a story. And I felt that poetry was not the medium, and I was trying to look for a different way. And in fact, I never thought I was going to write this novel. I thought I was going to write a poem where the audience would be asked to participate, a sort of choral, you know, participatory poem. And I had all these things in my head, but I just felt this urge to write something different. And I started at some point writing this exercise, this description exercise, and I started writing a description of what Managua had been like before the earthquake in 1972, and the route that I used to take from my house to the office every morning. And 5 pages later, a woman had appeared, and an atmosphere had appeared that made me realize that I was writing the novel that I had in my head for a long time, but that I had never been felt that I was mature enough to start writing. And the Indian woman came afterwards, you know, which is the more poetic side of the... Because I started writing this novel, and 250 pages later, I felt that the novel lacked something. So I went back, I threw all those 250 pages away, and I had this sort of vision of this Indian woman. I was in Mexico, and I remember maybe there was something about, you know, being in contact with the Aztec legacy, and And, you know, I'm always fascinated by, for example, the poems that are written in the walls of the Anthropology Museum in Mexico City that are very beautiful. And this spirit came to me, you know, the idea of this woman that would incarnate the Indian past. And that's how she got into the novel. And, of course, that's where I found the poetic avenue also. That was a poetic place where I could, you know, write a poetic prose. Because there is a temptation to write poetic prose for a poet, but but that also can come in between the story. You know, it can also not aid the story, but on the contrary, sort of make the story very contorted. So you have to keep a very delicate balance.
Well, it seems as if the narration by this orange tree is like the fertilizer for the novel. You know, the novel emerges out of the spirit presence, and that this is seen to be the transcendent world that informs the gradual politicization of the heroine. Now, is the book autobiographical?
Well, I think all books are a little bit autobiographical, but this book has a lot of my experiences in the underground, guerrilla, but also a lot of experiences of other people. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's more than anything, the feelings that the protagonist feels are very much what I felt, but not, you know, the circumstances, the facts are not at all autobiographical, or they are fictional.
I'm speaking to Jacunda Belli, the author of The Inhabited Woman. Now, I don't think I'm being unfair in telling listeners that this is a novel of tragic romance, and that at its end the lovers are not only separated, but both of them separately dead. in this way, it's an epic, I guess. And what is suggested, at least in the cycle that this book suggests, is that the spirits of the dead will in turn inspire others.
Right.
Presumably, I guess, the reader.
Presumably. Well, you see, my idea was to do a tragedy that wouldn't be a tragedy. I mean, that in their death, they find life. I remember while we were at, fighting the Somoza dictatorship, we used to have a saying that we are not going to give our death, we are going to give our life to freedom. And that's what I wanted to say is, well, these people died, but they are not really dead. I mean, what they died for is alive, and they put their part on this mission. And because of that, they are going to live forever, because we all achieve immortality in the measure that we stay with with the people who lived in our own time, in the measure that we leave a mark on life, on the measure that our lives take a useful purpose and fulfill a purpose. And I think that's how you achieve immortality, and that's how you are able to overcome the idea of death, this idea of, you know, annihilation and just disappearing from the face of the planet forever. And so there are two levels. One is the heroic level, that these people are going to live because their legacy is going to live in others. But also there is the level of nature, which is signified by the orange tree, which is that when we die, we become fertilizers. We become earth again, and when our bodies dissolve, we are back to the earth, and we would fertilize the roots of plants, and eventually, that's my dream. We would we will emerge and, you know, be part of a tree, be part, you know, and breathe again, and this is like the recycling of life, you know, like this serpent.
Well, what was particularly nice, it's as if the more choral or incantatory narration of the tree is an ongoing inspiration to Lavinia inside. And so it's as if life itself is the poetry of the spirit that precedes. I'm curious, I really don't know, what under what conditions are politically revolutionary books published in Nicaragua? Is there a difficulty in their circulation? Are they prevented from publication?
No, no, not at all. No, this book, in fact, has been very popular in Nicaragua. It's has had five printings and sold a lot of copies in Nicaragua for a small country. And I know it wasn't like that, you know, during the Somoza regime, which lasted for 45 years.
Yes.
That was a different story. I mean, you really could not read political books or, you know, not less of all revolutionary books. But during the revolution, of course, this was all, you know, very well. And now there is no problem. I mean, there is a situation of where we are learning at last to coexist with one another in Nicaragua. I mean, that's been a new development, let's say, in the history of the country, where winner doesn't wipe away loser, and there is a more institutionalized kind of democracy.
You are now living in Santa Monica, California. Do you consider yourself to be in exile?
Well, not really. You see, I married a man who was a National Public Radio's correspondent in Nicaragua during the years of the war, you know, the Contra War and all that. So, you know, we had talked about coming to the States at some point, and he lived in Nicaragua for 6 years. And after the electoral defeat of the Sandinistas in 1990, he said to me, well, now I'm not going to wait 6 years for you to, you know, for the supposedly another Sandinista victory. And I thought it would be important for me to change. You know, I think for writers, it is important to, if you have the opportunity to live two kinds of completely different lives, you should take it. And I thought this would be a completely different life, as it has been. And I thought also it would be important for me to get to know the United States better. I had come here to study when I was very young. I went to an advertising school in Philadelphia. And that was a good take on that time. And I thought it would be an opportunity for me to understand this culture better. And also I wanted to write a novel about the future, and to have access to information, and the research that I had to do was a good opportunity for me. So I took it.
This book of poetry from Eve's Rib is translated by Stephen F. White, and The Inhabited Woman is translated by Kathleen March. Have you begun to write in English?
No, I haven't. I'm writing in Spanish. I don't think I could write in English, you know, maybe if I live here for many, many years. But I think that it's very hard, once you start writing in your language, to switch to a different language. I don't feel that I have the command of the English language that I would need to write in English. And also I love Spanish. I think Spanish is a beautifully poetic language, and it has an incantatory tone that goes more with the kind of thing that I like to do. But, you know, you should never say that you're not going to drink of any water, so maybe.
So are you continuing to write poetry as well as fiction now?
Yes. What I am doing now is translating my own poetry into English. I can do that now much better. And that has given me a lot of satisfaction, because I am able to do a faithful rendering. Because in a way, when you write in a language and when you have to translate, you really have to rewrite. You have to write whatever is written in this language over again in the other language. And since I am the poet, I have the poetic license to twist and turn the translation the way I want and really render a faithful, translation of the poem. So, and be able to communicate the feeling and the rhythm and the music. And so that has been an interesting experience, actually.
Your writing is on the one hand so passionate and on the other so political. Have you felt an absence of those qualities in the American writing you've read around you?
Well, I think the political here is a completely different thing, you know, because it's colored with so many other complicated nuances. And I think in Nicaragua, the political had such a definite reality. It was not like a career, like here, you know, I'm going to go into politics. Nobody would say that in Latin America. I mean, politics come to you and you're forced to become involved because there is a situation of oppression, misery, injustice, whatever. And while here, I think you have the choice of being, of not acknowledging what is going on around you and being isolated, and you can live a perfectly normal life like that, however unsatisfactory that might be, or satisfactory, I don't know. And on the other hand, you can also get involved, but you get involved in a community level. You know, it's very hard to get to a level of involvement that really makes you a power player. While in our countries, you'd really feel like you're making a contribution. You really feel like what you're doing is very important. And especially if you are somebody who is educated and who has had a few privileges that other people have not had, then you have an incredible sense of what you can give. You know, if you have a sense of responsibility, you know that you have received from society something that you in turn have to give back. And I think I sense that here, that sense of social responsibility does not exist. It's not very widespread. I mean, some people have it, but I don't feel like people are taught that, you know, they have a responsibility with their time, with their country, with other human beings that are living at the same time, with the children that they're going to have and their time. So I think, you know, maybe now the children are getting it through the ecology movement and the environment and the preoccupation for that. But I think basically it's a society that tends to nourish the individual side to people more than anything.
You've written a novel which is basically one in which the members of the underground are distrustful of the heroine, Lavinia, because she has been educated in Europe. She has a house of her own left to her by an aunt. To what extent are the upper classes apart from political movements in South America?
Well, you see, that was one of the ideas that I had when I wrote this novel, was to talk about that phenomenon, because it's happened in Latin America. Even, for example, Che Guevara, who is such a figure, he was from a middle class. He was not a proletarian or a worker in a factory. He was a medical student, and his family was well off. Fidel Castro is the same way, you know. You know, in Peru you have revolutionaries who had the same kind of trajectory and the same kind of background. So I thought, you know, this is interesting. And I also had the same experience. How do you become a part of a movement who is trying to displace the people you are coming from? You know, I mean, the class you are coming from. And how does this relation of trust occurs? Because when you become when you go into a guerrilla movement, there has to be a trust, because you are in a way trusting your life to the people who work with you. And so, I I thought that was something to be explored, because I always felt a little guilty. I always felt like I even however much I did, I wasn't really, I always had to have on my shoulders the weight of whatever my family had done in the past, you know. And my family had been in the opposition to the regime. I mean, it wasn't a family that had been with the regime. But I know other people, for example, had brothers or sisters who were very much involved with the regime, and they became part of the revolution, and they had to deal with this problem in a more acute way. And so, it was solved in a way, because you become a part of those who you share their ideas with, and little by little they accept you, and little by little you accept whatever vision they have of you. But it's a like a bargaining proposition all the time.
Well, that integration is in many ways the subject of The Inhabited Woman, in which a yes. woman comes to be a part of the traditions that come before her, and also to be integrated and accepted by the people around her, and then to have in turn a sense of another kind of isolation, the isolation of the underground as well.
Right. And also because I think that is a valid not only in the case of a revolutionary, but also women, every woman who gives herself a different kind of role in society, in a way has to go through that right, you know, the right of being accepted as somebody powerful, as somebody who has something to say, as somebody who is the protagonist of her own life. And that is what The Inhabited Woman is about also. The rite of passage of this woman, who is a liberated woman, into a liberation that implies a social liberation, and also that implies a real taking command of her life and taking command of herself as a woman, and not just becoming the compañera of the man who is a revolutionary, but she becoming a protagonist and becoming a maker of history. And not just somebody who observes history being made by men.
I've been speaking to Jacunda Belli, the author of The Inhabited Woman, recently published by Curbstone Press. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. The land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with books of the mouse time.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.